Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps decision on the recently decided Trump v. CASA Incorporated. We're very pleased to welcome our excellent speaker, Edward Wanger, who is a partner at Holtzman Vogel. And special thanks to Albert Lin for moderating this discussion. Albert is the Chair of Issues and Appeals at Hunton Andrews Kurth. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions, so if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Albert, thanks so much for joining us, and I'll hand things over to you.
Great. Thanks, Edie. And thank you to the Federal Society for hosting what is now, I think, the third session that I've been a part of on Trump v. CASA. But now we know what the Supreme Court thinks and what they've said. So as Edie mentioned, I'm here with my friend Ed Wanger, who we've now known each other for maybe almost a decade. Before his current job as a partner at Holtzman Vogel, Ed was the Chief Deputy Solicitor General of Florida, and we know each other from his previous life as the General Counsel to the West Virginia Attorney General. Thanks for doing this with me, Ed.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, Albert. It's great to be working with you again.
So let's just dive right in. Can you start by setting the table for us? Just remind us what this case is about and how we got here.
Absolutely. So on January 20th, 2025, the first day of the Trump administration, along with a number of other executive orders, President Trump issued the Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship executive order. And what that essentially does is it lays out circumstances when a person born in the U.S. is not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is language taken from the 14th Amendment, which would mean that a person born in the U.S. would not be given citizenship by birthright. So the executive order also provided for a 30-day ramp-up period. Number of cases were immediately brought, and three of them were decided in short order, one in the District of Maryland, another in the Western District of Washington, and the third in the District of Massachusetts. Each one of these district courts preliminarily enjoined the executive order. In each case, the circuit court declined to issue a stay. The preliminary injunctions themselves barred the executive from enforcing the birthright citizenship order against anybody in the U.S., and this is what is commonly now referred to as a universal injunction. And this is something that's become a whole lot more frequent recently. I think that the majority opinion by Justice Barrett said that by the end of the Biden administration, there's a state of affairs where every major presidential act was immediately frozen by a federal district court. And in the first 100 days of the second Trump administration, district courts have already issued approximately 25 universal injunctions.
Great. So we ended up at the Supreme Court on that question of universal injunctions, right? The United States did not actually put the merits of the executive order before the Supreme Court. So, tell us what happened in the decision here. What was the vote breakdown? What did the court hold?
Yes, absolutely. So in a 6-3 opinion with the judges who were all appointed by Republican presidents in the majority, the court decided whether specifically under the Judiciary Act of 1789, whether federal courts have equitable authority to issue these types of universal injunctions. And the reason why is that to have that type of authority, obviously the courts need an act of Congress. And the only conceivable statute that anyone cited for the court's ability to issue these was the Judiciary Act of 1789. So that was a pretty bare bones statute itself. It specifically endowed federal courts with jurisdiction over, quote, all suits in equity, And what Justice Barrett's opinion did was what a good originalist opinion would do, and that's look back to see what courts were authorized to issue inequity whenever the 1789 Judiciary Act was first enacted. So basically, what they did was ask, or what Justice Barrett asked in her majority opinion, was whether they were sufficiently analogous to the relief issued by the court that at the time of ratification of the Judiciary Act, the passed the Judiciary Act, but also the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, most of that equitable jurisdiction was coming from the High Court of Chancery in England. So that was sort of the court that Justice Barrett was looking to figure out what was happening with the practice of equity at the time. And what she noted was that suits in equity were always brought by and against individual parties. The general rule in equity was that all persons materially interested in the suit were to be made parties to it. And that was it. The equitable relief extended to the two parties who were suing each other in equity. And that didn't change as the United States courts adopted the practice from England. No founding era courts of equity in the United States charted a different course. And if anything, it seems like the approach was taken that was against the existence of anything beyond relief that was extending just to the parties. In her view, and I think in the view of most commentators, universal injunctions were never a feature of federal court litigation until something in the 20th century. And as we've seen in other cases where you have an originalist historical perspective, most courts or the Supreme Court will usually say that practices coming that far or that sort of far past the ratification period are not a good indicator of what it was that the ratifying generation would have said. So she did take up a few other objections and a few other counterarguments, not only by the respondents, but also by Justice Sonia Sotomayor's primary dissent. And the first one was whether or not the Bill of Peace practice, which allowed the Chancery Court to consolidate multiple suits involving a common claim to the plaintiff, that the plaintiff could have against multiple defendants, as sufficiently analogous to justify the universal injunction practice. And what Justice Barrett's majority opinion said was this is essentially evolved into the modern class action procedure that's now governed by Federal Civil Procedure Rule 23. And instead of actually seeing that as an analog to universal injunctions, this basically means that class-wide relief should come through the class action process, and that was not before the court here. She also took up the question of taxpayer cases, which essentially was a state court practice where if someone had actually sued to enjoin a tax, or sometimes state courts would actually go ahead and enjoin the tax against all taxpayers. In the majority's view, the practice of doing that never gained nationwide acceptance. And it came too late to really sort of inform the question about whether or not universal injunctions were accepted at the time of the Judiciary Act of 1789. One of the more interesting questions in this case is the debates, and this has gone on and some of the separate opinions really picked up on this, is the extent to which universal injunctions are necessary to grant complete relief. And the notion behind that is essentially that in equity, courts may actually grant what's called, quote unquote, complete relief to a party. And that's given sort of the flexible nature of equity. It's a little bit different. It's supposed to grant parties what is this going to make them whole in situations where the sort of more strict application of the law might not actually answer that question. And both the associational parties, the states had based in the individual plaintiffs themselves had said, well, to actually grant complete relief in this case, it's totally impractical to not issue a universal injunction. And what Justice Barrett said was complete relief doesn't mean complete relief throughout the known universe or throughout the country. What it means is complete relief to the parties before the court. And with the parties before the courts, it was enough to say that these folks who had at this point all succeeded at the district court level, that the executive order could not be enforced against them. So that's an interesting question that has come up a couple different times. And it's it was the focal point of some of the separate opinions, which I'll get into in just a moment. And then finally, there were questions in debating about whether or not it was good policy to decide whether universal injunctions should matter. Both the states who had brought the suits, but also the associations, some of which had a couple hundred thousand members, said that to try to apply a patchwork enforcement of the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order would have just been tremendously unworkable. And Justice Barrett said, we hear you, but that's not the question before us. Right now, we're just deciding whether or not the federal courts have been given the authority and the power by Congress to establish this type of sweeping relief. So sort of in a nutshell, that's the overview of why it was that Justice Barrett's opinion for 500 members of the court said that universal injunctions at this point are a dead letter.
That was great. And I think that really covered the waterfront on what she held. So I have sort of two questions for you and they're related. So maybe I'll just sort of ask them both and let you kind of address it in the order, because I think they build on each other. I mean, I think the question on everybody's mind, right, is this the end for broad injunctive relief? And maybe in answering that question, you have to touch on what the court didn't decide in this case, right? Because there are a couple, as the court is wont to do, of very important footnotes about issues that they didn't reach. I'm not going to steal your thunder on that. And then, you know, there's other interesting things. I mean, you mentioned states asking for complete relief. I'm pretty sure they don't issue too. So, you know, whatever order you want to do it, but it does seem to me, right, that they're kind of two sides of the coin. I mean, is it the end for broad injunctive relief? And maybe you have to ask.
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer that question, the answer is almost certainly not. And as a matter of fact, earlier today, it looks like we actually have in a similar case, I believe it was a district court out of New Hampshire. I'm actually just checking to make sure that I have that right, but has now issued is universally enjoined the same Birthright Citizenship Executive Order, but it did so through the class action process. So it's sort of fast tracked certification of a nationwide class. And this is something that just came out, and I'm not even sure if there's a written order on this yet, but the upshot is that the class action procedure, which all of the justices have admitted, and Justice Alito has a little bit more to say about this, which I'll get into in a second, have acknowledged that class action procedure is the way to get broad injunctive relief. We see that in the context of this particular challenges to this exact same executive order, that courts are moving quickly to certify classes, perhaps maybe at the expense of actually rigorously applying Rule 23s. It sort of remains to be seen, and we'll see how that goes. But this is something that's moving quickly. And for that reason, I think it's pretty easy to conclude that we have not seen the end of broad injunctive relief, even if we have seen the end of district court universal injunctions in either single plaintiff or multi-plaintiff cases that are not involving a class certification. And to the question you asked, a lot of that turns on the fact that there are some questions that the court explicitly left unanswered. So one of which is whether or not Article 3 has anything to say about the question of broad injunctive relief. Obviously, I don't think that anyone's going to, at least from what I can tell, at least at this point, arguing that class actions themselves are going to violate Article 3. But Justice Barrett's opinion explicitly said that the Judiciary Act itself is the only question at issue here. She was not discussing whatsoever whether the case or controversy requirement of Article 3 was going to somehow offer a constitutional limit on the court's equitable power. The other one that I think is going to be very interesting going forward is whether or not the APA has anything to say about broad injunctive relief against executive action, particularly administrative rules. So the Administrative Procedure Act, which was not an issue in this case, actually grants a more specific type of relief than the Judiciary Act of 1789. And that is that plaintiffs can ask a court to, quote, set aside a new agency rule and apply in those plain terms. If you have one plaintiff or a group of plaintiffs, still not in a class action context, suing to actually set aside a new agency rule, the question is, does setting aside the agency rule apply to the entire country? Is that in and of itself a broader grant of relief than what you would otherwise have whenever you're applying just the rules of equity that have been in existence since more or less the birth of the nation? Whether this is the other one that I think is going to take a very interesting turn. And it's one, again, that is going to come up, I believe, to the court sooner than later. One, I think, that is probably very near and dear to your heart as well as mine, Albert. And that is, what happens whenever states sue for and asking for universal injunctions. That question about whether or not states themselves, whether to grant complete relief to a state acting in its plaintiff capacity, which also touches on issues of third party standing and other things, whether or not to actually grant them relief would have to entail a universal injunction. And some of the debate in this case in particular turned on the notion of, well, if you have the birthright citizenship executive order applying in one state, what does that mean for states who have to apply benefits or have to decide like who it is that's actually a United States citizen for purposes of any number of laws? Given that people move around an awful lot, the states were arguing that they might be in a position where they it could be impractical or even impossible to actually administer the work that they need to do if there's not some sort of uniformity across the board. Justice Barrett's opinion took this up, but did not take this up. She explicitly acknowledged it, sent it back down to for the lower courts to decide whether or not there could be some sort of more narrower injunction, but would nonetheless get at these concerns whenever you have a state plaintiff. She sent that back down to the lower courts to decide that in the first instance. So with that in mind, the answer is, I think that there's going to be certainly broad injunctive relief is not going away anytime soon. I think that we've already seen that the courts at the district court level are taking the invitation of the U.S. Supreme Court to decide cases on an expedited class action basis. And I think even the AARP order that came out a little while ago basically more or less gives a sort of lends the court's imprimatur to this type of practice.
Yeah, I mean, I have the same view, and it's good to hear that I'm not like a crazy person. But I mean, I think, you know, this is a really important decision, but there's a lot of ways in which the exceptions, I think, can sort of swallow the rule here, right?
Right, and I think that what that makes me think is probably the next case, not sure if it's going to be this term anytime soon, but I think what we're going to have to see is sort of a revitalization of basically the second coming of Walmart versus Dukes, where Justice Scalia a couple of years ago really did try to emphasize that the questions that go to class certification, whether issues are typical of the class, whether there's commonality. I think that you're going to see an awful lot of litigation turning on those two questions. And that might be something that in the context of removing the district court's ability to issue universal injunctions, whether or not that would nonetheless mean that there has to be some sort of loosening or some sort of revisiting of those questions when you're dealing with class-wide relief that in a lot of respects has to be decided on a quick expedited basis. Again, sort of the executive order issue here, by its terms, only had a 30-day ramping up period, which from having done class action, you know that you have as well, however, that is not as much time. It's actually sort of a blink of an eye for what it takes to actually go through the Rule 23 litigation process.
Yeah, and you mentioned AARP, and I mean, I just pulled it up while you were talking. I mean, I don't know that I've seen as much discussion of this language, and maybe we're not understanding it the right way, but it says, because courts may issue temporary relief to a putative class, and then it cites a treatise, we need not decide whether a class should be certified as to the detainees' due process claims, which were the claims at issue in AARP, in order to temporarily enjoin the government from removing putative class members while the question of what notice is due is adjudicated. I mean, that sounds to me like they're saying you can grant temporary relief on a class-wide
basis
without actually deciding whether a class is appropriate.
Exactly, which is what more or less for the purposes of what Judge Boasberg did, you know, whenever they're dealing with the flights. He basically said, look, this is such an important issue. If these flights take off and we can't get them back, this is sort of the height, in his view, of irreparable injury. So we're going to go ahead and err on the side of, you know, going ahead and skirting the traditional class action Rule 23 processes and just jump right to whether or not a TRO or an expedited preliminary injunction should issue. So I think that probably the best way to do it might be a sort of a legal or lawyer Weasley answer, but stay tuned on this. I think that there's going to be a lot of litigation, and I mean a tremendous amount, dealing with what it actually means to decide whether or not a putative class could get class-wide relief in the absence of an actual class certification under Rule 23, and whether the class action procedure itself is kind of baked into the equitable powers that the court has. Lots of questions, a lot of things that I think are going to be litigated vigorously as the time goes on.
Yeah, and I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but to focus on just, you know, two things that you mentioned that, as you pointed out, are the kinds of things that you and I have practiced for a decade. Mm-hmm. State suing, now that seems like a potentially a huge loophole. Obviously, it's going to depend on what the particular issue is here, right? I mean, like birthrights,
Right. Relationship
with people moving across borders, that feels like there might be an argument about complete relief. And then the other one is APA. Vacature. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, many of our listeners probably understand what that means, but for those who don't, that's the challenge mm-hmm. to every single federal rule, right?
Right. And
with some exceptions, Clean Air Act has its own, you know, provisions for mm-hmm. judicial review, although they're patterned on the APA. And so, Right. You know, a lot of the, when people think of the universal injunctions, I do wonder if sometimes there is a conflating of the two issues, right? Individuals suing over executive orders or things that would not be challenged under the APA. And then the whole bucket of things that would be challenged under the APA, which includes, again, like basically every federal mm-hmm. think of. None of that is affected directly, right, by this opinion.
No, not at all. I mean, the APA wasn't mentioned at all. It wasn't before the court. But you're right. If you think about the notion that most of the laws that people have to comply with, and this is everything from OSHA regulations to, you know, regulations issued by the department, the Department of Energy, anything else that could affect people that's not coming from Congress is coming, typically speaking, through an administrative agency rule. The chance and the opportunity for courts to actually still enjoin those rules on a class-wide country level basis is still at play. That is still something that, given the language of the Administrative Procedures Act and the relief that's afforded underneath that, that's not foreclosed by this opinion. So in that sense, even given some of the concern and the rhetoric that you've seen among a lot of different folks, there are a lot of different ways that broad injunctive relief may, in some respects, can still be given and be given very, very quickly.
I want to get into the separate opinions that you mentioned, because as you pointed out, I think there's a lot of important guidance, if you will, for the future. Mm-hmm. But there is one question that somebody's asked that I think kind of fits into what we're talking about. And I don't know if you have an answer to this. Is there any argument that this opinion applies only to preliminary injunctions and not permanent injunctions?
I haven't seen, based on the opinion itself, I haven't really seeing any sort of doctrinal reason why that would be the case. I mean, I do think that the Judiciary Act of 1789 doesn't speak to preliminary versus permanent relief. It's just whether or not relief can be issued in equity. And I think on that basis alone, thinking out loud a little bit, I would say that it would apply to both. That said, I think once we get into this a little bit further along, Justice Kavanaugh's opinion seems to, his separate concurring opinion does seem to draw in actually take into consideration the different interests at the different stages of litigation, not just at the preliminary injunction stage, but what he has phrased as the interim before the interim, which is all the time that goes into litigating a preliminary injunction itself. So based on the opinion itself, I would say probably not. There's not a reason in this opinion that I have seen that would suggest that this is going to go ahead and determine in turn on the state at which the litigation tends to be on. But that said, you can see the justices are already thinking about these questions. So in a future case, you might actually see an argument that could get some traction that would actually limit the effect of this opinion to the preliminary or even the TRO stage. Preliminary injunction stage is what the posture was in this case.
Yeah. Well, so do you want to, I mean, I don't need to sort of contrive how you go through this, but mm-hmm. do you want to turn to the separate opinions? I thought the Kavanaugh one was very interesting. I think he,
right.
They all write their separate opinions with a purpose, right? Alito's, I think, mm-hmm. has a very clear purpose. But Kavanaugh being arguably more of a swing to the extent that there is one, that seems to me to be really important, whatever it was that he was trying to do there.
Right, exactly. So really quickly, I think that, I guess taking them in order almost, I think that Justice Thomas and Justice Kavanaugh, they have done what I think is what they have done is giving cautionary lessons because they've been in court long enough. And I think, you know, both of them, and this is particularly true in some of the Second Amendment cases, have seen small loopholes turn into very big ways in which courts have gotten around. Otherwise, what district courts, and some of them don't necessarily agree with the pronouncements of the Supreme Court, have otherwise used to get around some otherwise pretty stringent Supreme Court pronouncements. So basically what Justice Thomas is concerned about is the question of complete relief. And what he wants to do is make sure that the notion of giving people complete relief is not going to end up swallowing the rule and being used to issue nationwide-esque or injunction or universal-esque injunctions under the guise of trying to actually complete the relief. He said the courts need to be very vigilant about making sure that this is something that the complete relief is a ceiling, that under equity, and this is particularly true in his view under Article 3 of the Constitution, that a court may not go further than granting complete relief to the parties at issue there. He sees that as a constitutional question, and he would just limit it to that. So he wants to make sure that the order doesn't get reversed. It's not that the complete relief is the goal to shoot for. It is that complete relief is the end of the road. And that should be, in that sense, court should be as, I guess, delicate and as minimalist as possible whenever you're dealing with questions about the remedy and equity. Justice Alito's opinion is similar in that sense. And basically what he wants to make sure is that, similar to what you and I were talking about a moment ago, and that's in the class action context, he is, I think, is already seeing that there's a potential for the class action process to be short-circuited, circumvented. He makes it very clear that this opinion says nothing about Rule 23's procedural protections for class certification. And in that view, he and Justice Thomas were also the ones who dissented in the AARP case with the situation we're talking about, where you had class wide relief before a class was issued. He is very clearly trying to get at and warn courts that that is not appropriate in his view. And he's really sort of underscoring both of that and also the third party standing doctrine, which is how some of the states were going about getting into this case as plaintiffs themselves, don't end up swallowing the rule themselves. I think his concern is really about making sure that third party standing, which the states have relied on, is not a way to get around what would otherwise be a limit on universal injunctions, depending on what it is that the lower courts do with the question about whether or not states can get something more akin to universal injunctions. But you're right. I think that among the concurrences, Justice Kavanaugh's particularly interesting. And I think what he's trying to do here is say that just because you've actually taken away the district court specifically their ability to issue nationwide or universal relief, that doesn't mean that all courts do. He basically says that it's not going to be the district courts themselves or the ultimate decision maker on time with these types of issues, which is, in his view, he's talking about what he phrases the interim before the interim. So if you think about a case going to final judgment, that's the end. The interim is what happens basically after a preliminary injunction is issued. And what that does is it just keeps, if it's granted, keeps the status quo until final judgment. He's concerned with what happens whenever you have major executive orders or major statutory pronouncements. What happens in the time that it takes to actually decide the preliminary injunction question? And when you're dealing with like large scale, monumental executive or legislative policies, you know, think everything from the Affordable Care Act to obviously the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order. What happens, and is it make sense? Does it make sense for there to be this patchwork that I think a lot of folks are concerned about if you take away the universal injunction, the tool from the district courts? He does believe that a nationally uniform answer on these questions, whenever you have a new federal statute or executive order, whether or not like that should be legally enforced whenever you're dealing with that, he believes, and I think very, very clearly, that there should be a nationally uniform answer. In his view, though, at the end of the day, his court, the Supreme Court, should be the one who gets to decide this. And I think he used an interesting turn of phrase that whenever you have what some people pejoratively refer to as litigation on the shadow docket. But whenever you think about this, if you're dealing with issues of national import that go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, in his view, and I'll quote this, he says a court should not and cannot hide in the tall grass. So basically, they should go ahead and answer the question deny it, but not presumptively not presume or put a finger in the scale of denying a request to administratively stay an order from a district court enjoining a statute or a rule that would otherwise, you know, go to the executive or Congress's authority to actually, you know, set the policy for the country. So he basically is taking the position that really the Supreme Court should take a more active role and they should decide these cases and decide them a little bit less on the notion that we're going to go ahead and granting or removing a stay, basically taking whatever affirmative action an applicant is going to request, not reflexively denying that or granting that relief only in sort of the exceptional cases, but actually deciding those cases a little bit more, certainly preliminarily, but reaching the merits to a certain extent. In that way, that's going to allow the body that actually has nationwide or universal authority to issue these types of injunctive relief, and making sure that you're not dealing with the same patchwork of you know, differing opinions and having the unworkability that the states themselves were talking about would be an issue in this case.
Right. So if I understand it correctly, I mean, SCOTUS mm-hmm. also would not grant a universal injunction necessarily, but what they would do would have precedential effect, right?
Correct. Yes, exactly. It would have an effect, and what it would do is would assure that you would not have the sort of the unworkableness of patchworks of different district courts in different places, having different small areas or circuits themselves applying different rules whenever you have important executive decisions that really can only function appropriately if they have some sort of nationwide uniformity.
It's so interesting. And I mean, we could get sucked down into this bog about the debate amongst the justices about the appropriateness of using the emergency docket, right? Whether there have to be opinions, mm-hmm. whether there should be arguments. And I think another thing that's sort of interesting is like maybe, you know, I wonder if Justice Kavanaugh's experience being more recent, right? I mean, mm-hmm. what he's seen on the Supreme Court has entirely been a very active emergency docket as opposed to, say, a Thomas or an Alito.
Right. When you think about it, not in the few years after he ascended to the Supreme Court, he was dealing with COVID issues. He was dealing with issues related to redistricting because the census had just come up. The 2020 election cycle, particularly litigious. So you're right. It's a bit of a different normal. And again, sort of going back and discussing some of sort of your big wins, Albert, even on the DC circuit, you were dealing with preliminary questions and he was on a few of the panels that were litigating at the preliminary level questions related to the constitutionality of the Clean Power Plan. So this is something that not even just with his tenure on the U.S. Supreme Court, but even his tenure on the DC circuit, he, I think, is showing that he has a greater comfort level in deciding these cases a little more rapidly, acknowledging that they might be the preliminary posture, keeping his mind open to be changed later on, given the preliminary posture, but making sure that also given his experience, sort of as a creature of the executive branch himself, understanding that there is a primary importance in making sure that whenever you have policies or rules or statutes coming out that really can't, that if you start applying them differently and sometimes, you know, entirely incoherently in different places, you're going to have a very, very big problem. So I think that he's basically saying we should basically take the power that we have and make sure that we're doing right by the American people and even the lower judges who really need some direction whenever these cases are coming fast and furious.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, in a way, I think he's signaling to them perhaps that, you know, I understand what you, the district judge, are concerned about, but don't overstep, right, your authority to try to address that broader concern mm-hmm. about patchwork. We're here. We'll take care of it. You decide your case in the way that you're allowed to decide it. It's going to get to us and we're going to. It is interesting. And there's probably a law review article to be written about Kavanaugh concurrences, because I do think kind of look at them. And I'm sort of ambushing you with this because we didn't talk about this ahead of time. But if you look over the history of his concurrences, you'll see a body of work that is aimed at this kind of a thing. He's frequently providing guidance and answering almost the sort of underlying concerns that, you know, policy concerns that people have about the impact of an opinion.
Right. And I do think that there's something to be said about the fact that he worked in the executive branch for a very long time. He was in the White House. He understands the importance and sort of the gravity of whenever you have certain proclamations coming from the chief executive and what actually happens whenever you have issues that really do need to touch on everything. And I think that you're exactly right. One of the things that I've noticed an awful lot about his separate opinions is that he is focused on what I would colloquially refer to as workability. I mean, he wants to basically make sure that there are some ways in which the lower courts aren't taking a look at the cases that come out and saying, okay, we understand the abstract principle. What in the world do we do with this now? And then you have sort of a different patchwork of procedures, different patchwork of tests that come out. And it takes a little while for those to coalesce. I think that he is sort of stepping up and sort of grasping the mantle of wanting to make sure that if there's someone who can actually discuss the ways in which the proclamations from the Supreme Court, he's basically saying, we've got your back in this case, but we're also going to go ahead and try to explain why it is that you can trust that we have your back and why it is that we're going to try to make sure that these steps that you see going forward are going to be done in a way that is workable so that you don't feel like you're out on an island and not entirely sure what it is that we're telling you to do.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like your word for it, workability. So we haven't mentioned her yet, but I think we have to talk about Justice Jackson's dissent. I mean, you mentioned Justice Sotomayor's dissent, which is interesting because I think it gets into the merits of the executive order, right, which we can maybe talk about at the very end. But Justice Jackson's dissent was given, let's just say, special attention by the majority. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of sort of talking head, analysis of maybe the sharpness with which Justice Barrett addressed the dissent. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to just kind of weigh in on what was her take on and why did it, draw such targeted criticism?
I think if I had to, part of the reason why I think it drew such targeted criticism is I think that Justice Barrett wanted to sort of cool things down a little bit, because I think that probably the best way you can describe Justice Jackson, particularly the front part of her dissent, is as a bit, I guess, existential. And I think that she actually uses that word in the second or third sentence in her dissent, and I can quote it here: the court's decision to permit the executives to violate the Constitution with respect to anyone who is not sued is an existential threat to the rule of law. And I think that this is particularly true, and I'm not sure if you necessarily would have seen this from some of the justices, but given that Justice Barrett herself is a former law professor, I think she takes the idea of the rule of law and the nuances of the law and the importance of getting the law right very, very serious. I think that there was a very clean, very almost a jarring break between what Justice Jackson, her dismissiveness, for lack of a better way to put it, of what the actual sort of legal question was before the court. And I don't think that that's necessarily unfair for Justice Barrett to have conceived of it that way. I think that she, Justice Jackson herself, described the majority's inquiry into the extent of the judiciary's power under the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a, quote, mind-numbingly technical query, called the legalese behind in the smokescreen. In her view, she says that there's a far more basic question of enormous legal and practical significance. And she said, may a federal court in the United States of America order the executive to follow the law? And with all sort of like, I guess, the weightiness of why that question sounds, I think that Justice Barrett and the justices who also didn't, weren't afraid to sign on to that portion of the opinion either, saw that as a bit of a problem whenever you're talking about the actual precise answer to the question, because may a federal court in the U.S. order the executive to follow the law? The answer is yes, but in accordance with the power that the judiciary has, that Congress has given it. So there is this sense of checks and balances, and really sort of the biggest debate between the majority and Justice Jackson's dissent is how do you actually calibrate those different power centers? In Justice Jackson's view, and I think that this is probably a fair way, since I've read the dissent a couple times, and I think this is probably about as fair as you can get about what her position is, if a federal court is faced with a lawsuit against an executive branch official, her view is that as long as the executive branch official loses, that everybody across the board, no matter what in the executive branch, needs to follow that district court's opinion, full stop. And I think she actually uses the term full stop. So in that sense, you're talking about almost a de facto rule that every time the executive, every time the Article II branch is sued under whichever official that might be, a universal injunction almost necessarily follows. And this is something that I think is a fair reading. It's one that I think is a fair reading of Justice Jackson's dissent. I believe that even Justice Barrett says that seems like it's a fair reading of the dissent. And it, when you think about that, that actually sort of runs afoul of any notion of judicial limit. That runs afoul of Marbury versus Madison right out of the gate. And it's one that even Justice Barrett has pointed out. So I think that Justice Barrett sees that Congress can tell the judiciary what authority it has under its powers of equity to issue a type of relief, and that's the check that Article 1 has in Article 3. Article 3 can tell the executive branch what it is that it can and can't do, whatever, what it can enforce and can't enforce, to the extent that there's a case in controversy before it, which generally requires two parties, one withstanding. And I think that she sees it as jarring that Justice Jackson doesn't seem to feel like there's much of a limit on that relationship between Article 3's prerogative to tell the executive what to do at all times and all places, no matter who it is that's actually before that particular court.
Yeah, and, I mean, go ahead.
No. I think that's basically about it. I mean, so yeah. Justice Barrett basically says that it's mostly rhetoric, and I think that she sees this as wanting to explain away and almost let people know that this is going to be okay. Like the world is going to go on, and this isn't the existential threat that we have if we actually limit the court's power to that which it is, you know, duly granted.
Yeah, the line that sort of jumped out at me from the majority was that Justice Jackson decries an imperial executive while embracing an imperial judiciary, which is, I think, basically what you described. If you've got a district court who can put a stop to anything that is, right, is unlawful.
Yeah, and I mean, when you think about even, there are some even broader structural questions there. I mean, the only court that's actually created by the Constitution is the U.S. Supreme Court. The lower courts, the district courts in particular, are creatures of, in this case, the Judiciary Act of 1789. That's whenever the first courts were established, and Congress has always been understood to have the power to tell those courts, which it creates, still under Article 3, but there's prerogative that Congress has about the power that the court can actually wield whenever it's dealing with the issues that are brought before it. And there's no mention of any limit of that whatsoever in Justice Jackson's dissent. And that sort of does go to the core of what it actually means to have checks and balances and separation of powers. Because if you don't have that, then you do have an imperial judiciary, which can just come in. And whether or not there is, even if you stretch the idea of case or controversy beyond the way that that phrase can be naturally interpreted, then you do have just a freewheeling monarchical judiciary. And it's really hard to not read Justice Jackson's dissent as asking for precisely that.
Yeah.
So I do think that given the sort of what I believe was that type of, a lack of a way to put it, glossing over of that, those sort of fundamental premises, I think that that's probably why you saw six justices of the majority all sign on to what was one of the sharpest rebukes that I've certainly ever seen Justice Barrett put into an opinion, and one that I haven't seen probably since Justice Scalia was writing.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that kind of language was in like every Justice Scalia opinion, right? So, but another amount, but it does seem like a lot for Justice Barrett.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about broader ramifications. Then we talked about this, you know, what is the import of this opinion for, you know, individual plaintiffs and states seeking to enjoin executive actions and regulations and all that. But what about broader ramifications? And I'll sort of let you sort of stop and see what your reaction to that is. But there are actually two questions that from the audience that get specifically to that. But why don't I stop, and then, I mean, we can explore those questions after your initial reaction.
Right. I think the broader ramifications is basically what I would imagine is that you're going to start seeing less judge shopping, forum shopping on both sides of the political spectrum. If you have, you've had, I think, sort of the interest groups and even some states on both sides saying this is a judge who we feel is going to be a receptive audience. If that judge doesn't have authority to regulate anyone outside of what could otherwise be a pretty sparsely populated district, you're not going to see the same incentives to go after those judges. So what you might actually see more broadly speaking is people picking and choosing whether or not they want to even bring these cases in the first place out of fear of, you know, developing bad precedent if their issues are, if the cases only arise in jurisdictions that you don't feel like you're going to get the audience in front of the circuit that you really want. So I think that there's going to be, in that sense, a little bit of a difference in how strategic litigation is brought. I think that probably what you're going to see at this point is a lot of states and a lot of state attorneys general thinking long and hard about how they want to structure their arguments for seeking broad relief whenever they're plaintiffs. I think that in that sense, you might actually see more states getting involved. It's certainly something that even from back of our days in West Virginia was picking up steam, Albert. But I do think that you're going to start to see if there is a concern with individual plaintiffs being able to seek any sort of broad injunctive relief, you might actually see state AGs becoming more aggressive and taking more positions. And that, I think, is going to lend itself to an awful lot of, you know, questions about third party standing that Justice Alito identified. So those are going to be big issues. And then obviously the one that's going to be very big, and I would assume is going to involve a lot of litigation in probably the very short term, is class action. You're going to have different judges in different courts either wanting to move forward and just more or less saying, okay, if I can't enjoin this action nationwide, cool, sounds good. I will just go ahead and check the class action box and we'll go ahead and proceed as we were before, versus other judges who will take Rule 23 very, very seriously. And that's something that I'm sure that there's some law review literature out there when it comes to what different judges are thinking about that. In my view, I think that remains to be seen. And I think that calculus is going to change an awful lot. That's a question that I would imagine probably within the next 10 years will be up at the Supreme Court again.
Yeah, you make a really good point about that last one, because it's not like... Mm-hmm. It's not like there's not a whole body of jurisprudence on class actions already. And there's like a whole category of class action lawyers that were not involved in cause litigation.
Right.
Right. And, and suddenly they're like, oh my gosh, right. Now everybody's interested in what we do. So, I mean, you mentioned, you know, Walmart v. Dukes, you know, Redux. I mean, we could see a lot of interesting class action jurisprudence perhaps being made in a very fast way.
I think so. And I think that obviously has ramifications, certainly beyond the cause litigation. You're going to see that if it does start affecting the way in which Rule 23 is interpreted, you'll see that affecting securities litigation, you'll see it affecting mass torts. That, I think, is something that, like I said, remains to be seen, but stay tuned, grab your popcorn. I think that that is definitely going to be something that is going to first, I think, churn up the law review articles real quickly. But at the same time, you're right. I think it's going to open up a brand new avenue for class action experts, both on the plaintiff side and defense side, in areas that they are not used to operating in. So that's going to be, I think, a very, very exciting development in the law. And we're going to see it coming quickly, I believe.
Yeah, no,
If today's docket is any indication, I think it's going to be even more quickly than I would have thought whenever you and I first started talking about this case, given that we've already got our first birthright citizenship class action certified.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, if you're a securities lawyer, if you're a mass torts, consumer protection, any of those, you should also be interested in this opinion and what it's going to do. It's because there's going to be bleed over into your world. And vice versa. Somebody asked, does this mean that even garden variety challenges to laws, and I assume they mean statutes as opposed to regulations, must be class actions in order to achieve permanent injunctions or declaratory relief that the statute is unconstitutional if applied to anyone? So, I mean, I guess it's a question whether facial challenges now must be brought as class actions.
That's actually a really good question. And that was one that whenever I was reading this, I was thinking about that myself, because you do have questions about I mean, I haven't gotten into the pleadings and the complaints at the lower courts about this, but I would imagine that the argument is that anything, any sort of restriction on birthright citizenship across the board is facially unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. I think that a fair reading of this is we should basically take a look. But there are, I mean, there is some precedent when it comes to questions about facial relief and whether or not that actually extends to the parties themselves or something more broadly speaking. One of the ones that, you know, I think everybody actually would recognize is that was an argument that even President Lincoln made in the sort of immediate aftermath of the Dred Scott decision. So I think that this is a question that you haven't seen litigated frequently. I think that a lot of times whenever a statute is stricken as facially unconstitutional, typically speaking, the whether it's a state government, local government, federal government that was subject to that injunction tends to just fall into line and say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and choose to agree with the order out of the fact that we're not going to go ahead and make everybody sue or go through the class action process. I'm not sure at this point, and I think that that's going to be something that you might see litigated more often. You might see, okay, this particular plaintiff got facial relief. It's not just as applied to him, but you might see a municipality test the waters a little bit and say, okay, we will not violate your rights. We're not going to do X, Y, Z, even though the court has said this is unconstitutional, but yeah, we're not going to change our policy unless and until you bring your class action. So again, it might lend itself to just reflexively bring class actions, but this is one that I think is an answer that the court doesn't really or at all address, but I think that it does actually raise that question about what does it mean if you have a statute stricken as facially unconstitutional. I think on the four corners of this case, it would say, no, I mean, that's just limited to the parties themselves.
Right. Yeah. Certainly as far as the injunction goes, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I guess you get, right. you can get your declaratory relief, but mm-hmm. right, what is that? You know, a similar question is, does this case mean the overbreadth doctrine is dead? More generally, is there an argument that CASTA doesn't apply in the First Amendment context because of the unique importance of First Amendment rights?
That, I think, is going to be the biggest question, is what actually happens in the First Amendment. There has been, I think, given the unique injury that's inflicted by the chilling of the First Amendment, I've noticed that courts in a lot of cases have felt more comfortable, for lack of a better word, sort of relaxing requirements on standing, relaxing the requirements on even issuing certain injunctive relief based on the fact that if you do have chilling effects, it sort of has those second level injuries on the people who otherwise might want to say something, otherwise might want to express themselves, but are afraid of doing so given the fact that there is, you know, some concern with the way in which a vaguely written law might be interpreted. My best suspicion about this is that what you'll see going forward is there's going to be a reluctance to, I think, relax any First Amendment jurisprudence given those unique considerations. I think that you've seen this in a bunch of different cases in a bunch of different areas where the First Amendment jurisprudence tends to be a little bit sui generis compared to some of the other constitutional challenges that are out there. So my best guess, and this is only a guess, is you'll probably start to see a little bit of a divergence and even some ways in which people distinguish cases like this, which are brought into the 14th Amendment in the Nationality Act versus the ones that are brought into the First Amendment.
Yeah. I thought those are both really good questions. I mean, the ramifications of this opinion, I think, are, it's really hard to get your head around how far it could be.
Yeah. Yeah, for what I thought was a relatively short opinion of Justice Barrett, there's a lot that's packed in there, and there are a lot of questions. Even though, I think that the questions for the audience have been fantastic because they're the ones that I was struggling with as well whenever I was reading this. And again, if you are a constitutional lawyer, I say buckle up because I think that the number of questions that should be litigated at this point, I think, have grown rather substantially. So it's not going to be a boring time if you're practicing this area of litigation.
Yeah.
And seeking injunctive relief.
So we've got six more minutes. I've got two more things for you. I mean, the first is, I don't know if you want to demur on this, but what about the merits question? I mean, do you have any sense the court is going on this?
So I think that probably I'm a little bit less familiar with the merits question. I know that there's some interesting arguments about what it means to be under the jurisdiction thereof, as that phrase was initially construed by the 14th Amendment. I think that if I had to look for any tells by either the government, by the executive branch, by the justices in the majority, or even by what's going on in lower court, I would think that the government has a tough road to hoe to actually say that the birthright citizenship is going to be constitutional. And the reason why I say that is, I think this is something that the dissents actually pointed out, is if the government was that persuaded that it had the right position on this, they might not have necessarily only sought certiorari on the, emergency relief, pardon me, on the question about nationwide injunctions. They would have basically said this is constitutional and we should be allowed to proceed forward with it. Obviously, unless I've missed one, it looks like across the board, the lower courts have all rejected the arguments. They've held that this is going to be a violation, certainly, of the 14th Amendment. And I think that there's something to be said about the notion that not one of the justices in the majority, either the majority opinion itself or the concurring opinions, said one word about the actual merits of the case. That came through only in Justice, primarily Justice Sotomayor's dissent. But I think that given that there's an awful lot of quietness about the folks that you would otherwise think might be potentially gettable when it comes to this question, I think at the very least, they're not comfortable saying that they're ready to even suggest or opine that the United States has it right on this point. So all that says, I put my finger on the scale of whenever the merits are actually litigated, I would doubt that it's going to go in the way of the federal government.
So before we wrap, is there anything else that I've forgotten that you want to mention?
No, I don't think so. Anything else that I've forgotten that you think that I should cover? This, like I said, this was a jam-packed opinion. It was a little bit on the longer side, even though the majority was a little bit on the shorter side. But I think that what was most interesting was what was not decided. We know for right now, the only thing that we know is that a district court dealing with a non-class action in a non-APA case can't issue a universal injunction. What that means going forward is there's going to be a lot of creativity and a lot of different ways that people will try to get that broad injunctive relief. And this will not be the last time the Supreme Court in what I think is going to be sort of the next few terms is going to have to determine the meets and bounds of broadly issued injunctive relief against high profile, very important executive or congressional actions.
Great. Well, thanks, Ed. I thought this was great. I thought we got some really good questions from the audience. And like you said, I think it's, you know, stay tuned and buckle up. It's going to be a full employment program for lots of lawyers.
Yep. Thank you, Albert. I really appreciate it. And thank you, Edie.
Great. Yeah. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Ed for speaking with us today and calling in from France. And thank you, Albert, for moderating. And we're also so grateful for the audience's participation today. Thank you all for joining us. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.